My name is Richard Rosario, and I'm a victim of the criminal justice system by being incarcerated for 20 years for a crime I didn't commit.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the stories of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Listen to the heartbreaking true accounts of wrongfully convicted people and their journey to exoneration. Thanks so much for listening. Richard Rosario spent 20 years of his life in prison for a murder he did not commit. He's only recently been freed and still, obviously, has some trauma issues associated with his experience. I need to stop to tell you about one of my amazing sponsors. I am always looking to learn about new things. And if you're like me, you are too. That's why the Great Courses Plus is great for both of us. It's a video on demand service that gives you access to thousands of lectures on so many topics. You learn things through short video lectures from top professors. And you can watch them anytime, anywhere, and from any device. I just watched a great course that everyone can use, Fundamentals of Photography. I'm a huge scrapbooker, and I feel like sometimes I have to take the same shot like 100 times just to get it right. But with this course, made in partnership with National Geographic, I've gained a lot of valuable techniques so I can get it right the first time, and my family is a lot less angry with me. I also want you to try the Great Courses Plus. As one of my podcast listeners, when you sign up, you'll immediately get a free month of unlimited access to all of the lectures. So you can start your free month today by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/actual. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/actual. Richard's story is told in a somewhat different format than previous episodes. As you will hear, his passion and raw emotion show through in a more free-flowing format than you're used to. I'm Brooke, and this is Richard's story.
My life was really, I was always like displaced, you know. I came from Puerto Rico. I was born in Puerto Rico, raised up by a single mother, two other brothers, and 5 sisters. So it was kind of real hectic in my house, and it was difficult, especially after my mom moved to the States, to pay attention to any one single child when she had so many kids set up. So, you know, you come from Puerto Rico, which is this beautiful island, pristine water, and you live a life where you don't know about poor or rich. You just live life, and, you know, there's always food on the table. And I came to this country, my mother struggled. So, you know, we grew up at times, you know, we always ate, but, you know, the meals were scarce. And just it was really difficult for my mother raising up 8 kids on her own. And so I took to the streets. I didn't take to the streets. I went to school. And, you know, you start learning the culture of the United States. And in that time, the Bronx, which was, you know, just ridden with drugs and crime. And anybody who knows about the 80s, it was just a disaster. So here's this immigrant kid coming, don't know English. And now years pass and I'm trying to fit in. And so I've gotten in trouble. I had a juvenile record, and it was just hectic. Like, you know, my whole concept of life was just blurred. You know, I'm in a new country, and the culture is about sneakers and clothes and everything I never knew existed. You know, in Puerto Rico, they put anything on me, and I wasn't complaining. But now here I am in the United States, and everything is about materialism. And so I grew up, you know, eventually acclimating to the culture of the Bronx, hip hop. But, you know, I always knew that you know, I could have done great things, but, you know, these are your contemporaries. Go outside and play, and they're there. You go to the corner, they're there. And, you know, I grew up in this environment, and as a kid, you know, I was led, and like most teenagers, by their friends to, you know, make the mistakes, break windows and doing things like that. And I got in trouble with one of my older friends who was arrested for robbery. And he committed a robbery one day. He gave me some credit cards, and I was fine with that. I was 15 years old. And that's when my first contact with the criminal justice system happened. And that's the picture that was in the precinct that was eventually picked out. And, you know, I was wrongfully convicted. But I ended up meeting a beautiful woman who I'm with to this day, my wife. And she was always about her work, her job, and, you know, her family. And, you know, this woman tried to, you know, work and pull me to the other side. We finally had my daughter Amanda in 1992. And I just tried. I worked legitimately. I had a job. But, you know, growing up in the city at this time, it was just like overbearing. Now I have a daughter. Then we had our son in 1994. And I started really thinking, what am I doing with my life? You know, I'm 20 years old. I don't have a consistent job. My father-in-law helps me here and there with jobs, but life in New York was just too hectic for me. You know, my reputation as a young juvenile on the street, the cops have my name in the precinct, and anything that could go wrong can go wrong in New York when you're not living, you know, regular civilian life. And so by the age of 20, I was already away from the streets. I was already working legitimate. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to leave New York. And that's when I decided to go to Florida. Like the story goes, everything from there just went downhill because, you know, I'm away from the city. I'm living my life. I'm working on getting a palm, bringing my wife and my kids over. And, a couple of months later, they're talking about that they're looking for me for a murder. And, you know, initially I thought my mom was mistaken because she's a hit. She was here in the United States for 35 years, but she never lost her accent, her culture. And so in my mind, maybe she misinterpreted what the detectives told her. And, you know, I called my wife and I spoke to my sister, and they said the same thing, that the cops were looking for me for murder. And it's a crime that, you know, I live with a free conscience. I have never committed, you know, and despite the mistakes I made as a teenager, I have never taken a human being's life. And I said that, you know, there's no way, and I came back.
To clarify Richard's story, he had married and started a family while in New York, but wanted to start working with a clean slate, so he decided to look for work in Florida. While he was in Florida, his wife and family stayed in New York, and he planned eventually to send for them when he was financially stable. During his time in Florida, he spoke with his mother, who told him that the police were looking for him, and so he returned to try and understand the reason for this search.
You know, when my wife told me this and I know who I'm dealing with, I said, well, you know, this got to be a mistake, you know. And I came back and I called the detectives from my mother's house and in the Bronx. And I told them I'll be coming into the precinct. And I guess they traced the call because 10 minutes later, they arrived at my mother's house. Now, you know, and I want everybody to understand is that as soon as I saw the police, when they came knowing that I was going to go to the precinct, I had a little like fear, like, you know, a little chill ran through me. And for one moment, I thought about going out my mother's back window. And, you know, this is the first time I'm ever saying this story. And this is the honest truth, because it just something seemed wrong. When, you know, I'm calling the police, telling them I'm going to the precinct. And 10 minutes later, they're like, ambush, like five cars. But, you know, I looked at my mom and my mom told me, yo, you didn't do nothing, man. You know, there's no reason for you to be afraid. And I was like, you're right. And encouraged me, my mother telling me that. So I opened the door for the detectives. They came in. There was no, you know, it didn't seem like they was really alert for a murderer or in fear. Or, you know, there wasn't that much security. It's pretty much like you open the door for any other person, and they come in, and the pleasantries, how you doing? And he's talking to my mother, and one detective, Martinez, is talking to my mother in Spanish, and they comfort her, letting her know everything's all right, we're just going to go to the precinct, and ask her some questions. So I'm like, all right, this sounds good. You know, I know where I was at, and, you know, this is nothing that I'm worried about because I've never taken a human being's life. So it doesn't matter where I was at this point. It's just something I would never be involved with. So I left with them. But before I left my mother's house, the detectives told me something that really gave me the chills. They said, we have to cuff you because it's procedure. And, you know, we have to do this to take you out of your house. And, you know, when they put them cuffs on me, it didn't feel right. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm leaving with them voluntarily. Why am I getting put into cuffs? So, you know, they did not read me my rights. This is what's weird about it, that I'm wondering, if I'm voluntarily coming to the precinct with you, why are you cuffing me? They didn't read me my rights. But at the precinct, they took me there and they interrogated me about this crime. I mean, a lengthy interrogation between three different detectives.
After calling the police of his own free will, they showed up at his door and asked him to come down to the station for questioning, during which they required him to be handcuffed, and he underwent an intense interrogation process.
I told the detectives, they asked me every question in the book about things now related to this crime, things related to this crimes, and I guess they're trying to, like, see if they catch me in the lie. So after 24 hours, you know, of them switching on and off, they told me, listen, you know I'm tired. 5 in the morning at this time. And they said, well, you know what? You're never going to see your daughter again. We know you're the one that did it. And if you don't confess, you know, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. So Detective Martinez pushes a paper and a pen and said, you're ready to write your statement? And I said, yeah, I'm ready to write my statement. And my first statement, and this is documented, I said, I've never killed anyone in my life, and God knows. And that was my statement. And when they took that, they were upset about it. And they started telling me how I'll never see my kids again. And, you know, I get a little emotional because I remember, like, you know, their whole tactic was not about finding out the truth, but was more like trying to push me to confess to a crime I didn't commit, threatening me with not ever seeing my children again. And, you know, the more I think about it, you know, I'm a 20-year-old man. I wasn't stupid. I didn't commit the crime. But, you know, their tactics was basically to try to force me into confessing into a crime I didn't commit.
Let's talk about the crime of which Mr. Rosario was being accused. On June 19th, 1996, a man named Jorge Collazo and his friend Michael Sanchez were walking in the Bronx when they came upon two men identified as one African-American and one Latino. There was an apparent argument, and Mr. Collazo was fatally shot. A local apartment porter and a hot dog stand vendor both witnessed this crime. Mr. Rosario gave the name and number of 13 witnesses and was able to describe with detail the locations of where he had been while he was in Florida. But no one had looked into these alibis.
So eventually, they go through the process, and I'm thinking it would be a day. And then they put me in the lineup. I got picked out of the lineup, and a week passes, and then a month. And now I have lawyers appointed to me, and I'm telling these lawyers, listen, the people I was with was in Florida. And bear in mind that I gave the police officers a whole page, a statement with 13 people, 13 phone numbers, addresses, descriptions, because, I mean, they were really trying to see if they catch me lying. So, for instance, they said, oh, you was in Brooks House. So how Brooks House look in Florida? So I said, well, Brooks House, as soon as you come in, to the left is the living room. So I get into the detailed description, and, you know, I'm thinking, all right, they're going to check it. It's going to clear out, and I'll be out in a week. And, you know, then I went through it with my lawyers, the same thing. Listen, I was in Florida, get the information. The bus ticket is here. The people I was here, job interviews, phone numbers, Western Unions. I mean, this is a paper trail. I was rich with material that you could just, you know, have in black and white to prove my where I was at this time. And my lawyers didn't do that. So there was a change of lawyer, and a year passes. And I'm going through so much because I know I'm losing my mind. I don't belong in here. What am I doing here? And I went through this, broke 13 witnesses. One of them is a deputy sheriff. One of them is a federal correctional officer now. Another one is a pastor. And what's so sad about it, man, is that 20 years later, I'm here in Florida with my wife, and I decided to go and do my own investigation to see if our law enforcement, if the district attorney and our public representatives, you know, maybe it was too difficult for them. Maybe they couldn't find it. And here I am 20 years later, and I found every witness, the apartment which I described in depth, it's there. And I'm narrating it like, you know, how could they do this in good conscience? And, you know, it's just terrible for me to realize, you know, 20 years later, what I knew back then, that all it was is a trip, you know, a couple of phone calls, you know, these public resources that are available to them because they're public officials. You know, this is, you're supposed to be representing the public. You're supposed to be, you know, making sure that the public receives true justice, that a criminal is not in the street. And here is a person that is accused of something. Maybe there was a mistake. Maybe it's a wrong identification. Things happen. And maybe that was the problem. And you could solve that problem by looking into things and looking at the facts.
I asked him to tell me more about the trial. And he did. And then he went on to talk about many of the other legal injustices that he endured. It was not my place to interrupt.
I mean, years later, we come to find out that the district attorney's theory at trial, they knew was a lie. They said that me and this kid never knew each other, that we just bump into each other. We both happen to have guns. And allegedly, the shooter, the perpetrator, who was not me, shot this kid. And it was coincidental. They don't know each other. But now that I'm out and we find this, because I started finding in 20 years and reading, I'm obsessed. I'm trying to get out. I'm trying to figure out who did this killing. I'm trying to, you know, do the work that's going to free me. And I come to find out that there was a getaway car, that this murder was premeditated, that the shooter called the victim by his name, and the district attorney and the police knew this. But they've come to the conclusion, and this is something, on June 24th, I went to court. The terms of them vacating my sentence after, and remember this, Robert Johnson left office on last year, in December of last year, because she came into office in January, Marcel Clark. And 20 years of me litigating in the courts, every court said that I was guilty of sin, that my lawyers gave me the best representation. They never investigated my alibi. The only people that got involved and it was a quagmire was the federal courts, because they said, listen, they violated this guy's right. But because of AEDPA, and anybody knows this bill that the famous Bill Clinton passed that took away the rights from federal courts to give men like me relief, innocent men relief, the AEDPA Act did not allow, which is the Anti-Terrorist Effective Death Penalty Act, did not allow the federal courts to give relief because they said, we disagree with the state court's ruling, but under this, under the AEDPA Act, we have to give deference, which is we have to give credibility to the state court's ruling. And just because we disagree with it is not enough to overturn a conviction, even of innocence. So, you know, for 20 years, I'm caught in this quagmire of being denied the freedom that I deserve. The district attorney, Robert Johnson, never investigated my alibi. I mean, my last appeal was denied in April. In April of last year, my last appeal was denied.
I can't imagine what it must feel like to know that your last appeal, your last chance at freedom, is denied.
And all of a sudden, this woman comes in office. The first thing she does, she sends investigators to Florida on Wednesday, on a Friday. She sent investigators to Florida, which was March 18th. On March 23rd, I was released after 20 years just based off that investigation. But her terms were, which is kind of, it's kind of contradicted, right? She says, well, you know what? We're going to let you go based on our investigation, and which is still ongoing, we're going to let you go and agree that you had an effective counsel. that your lawyer's messed up. And we're going to let you go based on that. And then we're going to investigate and revisit the terms of dismissal, which is, you know, they could say his actual innocence based on their investigation. And, you know, so on June 24th, we go to court and they have yet concluded their investigation, but they want to dismiss the case. They said, hey, we're going to dismiss it. Your lawyer's messed up and we're still investigating this case. And I did something that was unprecedented. I said, well, you know what? I'd rather this case stay open until you finish your investigation, because there's only two conclusions that you could come to, which is that there was overwhelming evidence of innocence and that I'm innocent.
In March, Richard Rosario was supposed to have his case dismissed. But due to his own request, the case is still actively being investigated. He says he wants his innocence to be proven rather than the charges to simply be vacated. Needless to say, this is extremely unusual.
Because what the public should know is before an attorney gets a case, the police get the case and they do their due diligence, their investigation, they do their paperwork, they question witnesses. And then after that, guess who gets the case? The DA. And the DA gets to choose what she will disclose to you, what they will not disclose to you. And then it comes to, you know, the point of they get to alter the facts of a case, because now we know 20 years later that my case, they said it wasn't premeditated. It was coincidental. No, we know this is premeditated, but the problem with the case back then that they couldn't prove that I premeditated to killing a complete stranger. They couldn't prove that me and this complete stranger didn't know each other. So they hid the fact that the shooter called the victim by his name, because they can't prove I know the shooter. They hid the fact that the main witness said that he couldn't identify the shooter, that he didn't know who it was. They hid the fact that the shooter was threatened, the victim was threatened 2 weeks before the crime happened, and the police never investigated who were these people, but they could never connect it to me. So and this is my perspective, but the paperwork and the facts speak for itself. If you knew there was a motive, if you knew there was people with a motive to kill this kid, if you knew that the victim and the perpetrator knew each other, these are all pivotal facts to present at a trial. You hid them because you knew that you had the wrong man and you could not prove all those elements. And this is what gets me angry, and this is why also encourages me to know that while I was in prison, I went to college, I learned the law, I learned how to be patient, I learned how to, you know, run organizations and businesses. And now that I'm out, you know, I'm still battling with them because, you know, they wanted to dismiss it on those terms. And I said, no, I don't want to dismiss on those terms. So that's basically, yeah. But, you know, it's not angry at all public servants, because obviously every public servant is not corrupt. Every police officer is not a police officer. Every correctional officer, you know, these are people that get put in a position in life where their duty is not to themselves but to the public. And you have some of these people that go into office and say, well, yeah, I'm going to take the oath, but when I get the position, it's about me. It's about my career, my money, how much more I could get. It's about, you know, these lobbyists rubbing elbows with them and doing, and this is the problem. There's a disconnect between the people that they represent and the public officials that's supposed to be representing them. We don't hold them accountable. We don't say nothing. People aren't voting, and especially lower income, poor people. We're not doing anything, but everybody wants to complain. Everybody wants to rally. But, you know, these things have already been proven to me from just being, you know, a viewer just watching things from the outside. They're ineffective. So, you know, if people have a right to voice their anger and their grievances, but, you know, let's find solutions. And that's what I'm out here, you know, I'm working on creating, you know, to find solutions for everything that's going on in the justice system, and not just in the courts, but in corrections. Can you believe that a man that has committed a crime gets released, he gets programs, he gets housing help, he gets all these things, And they're ineffective, and that's one thing I want to make clear. They get these things, they're entirely ineffective. I was in there. I've seen what type of programs these guys take. And the programs these guys take are just paychecks for these state employees that tell me, hey, go in there and teach these guys how to not be angry. This is what they're releasing to the public. But even those guys get a certificate, a little handout. They get a little money. They get, you know, resources to go to. You know what? After 20 years of being in jail for a crime I didn't commit, I didn't get nothing. I didn't get nothing. I didn't get car fare. I didn't get bus fare. I didn't get anything. Had I not had my family, I would have been in a shelter living like some kind of, you know, a person that doesn't exist in life.
I've heard this mentioned by many exonerees, that people who are exonerated get less assistance after being released than those who commit a crime
in this country. And so, you know, there's a lot of problems in the system that's affecting us. And you know, someone, you know, I had a debate with somebody, say we have to change things from the top. You can't change it from the top. You know, these Supreme Courts, these presidents, these, you know, senators are insulated. But they start somewhere, right? They start on the ground. They start as regular citizens in a town that put their career together and get into public service. So it doesn't start at the top. It starts at the bottom, and that's where I'm, you know, that's where I'm going to start my life and my career at the bottom, and pushing this in the right direction so it doesn't happen again. And at least that the people that are, you know, affected by crimes are not being reaffected by the same people they're releasing out here unprepared.
I asked Richard what prison was like, and though he got somewhat off topic, what he had to say was important and needed to be said.
You know, Cuomo talks about this, and he makes some nice talk about, you know, how he's changed things and how the city and the state is much better with him there. But I remember when the escape happened in Clinton, you know, that escape happened and millions of dollars of taxpayer money went for a manhunt that was created by officers in the Department of Corrections. It wasn't that civilian alone. I was in prison. I was in Clinton. There's no way them guys got back there without an officer letting them there. There's no way they got the tools without an officer giving them to them. Because every civilian goes to a bigger scrutiny of security than everybody else. But you know who was able to pass all them tools? The correctional officers. And only one of them took the fall. And you know what? These guys get misdemeanors and they retire with their pensions. How wrong is that? Four correctional officers were found guilty of gang assault in Attica Correctional Facility. And these guys topped out to misdemeanors and kept their pensions. What criminal gets to retire with a pension? What criminal? I did 20 years for a crime I didn't commit, and I don't have anything. And those criminals who were convicted, who were given the trust of the community, copped out to gang assault, to assault an inmate because he was black or because he was a Hispanic or white, because, you know, racism doesn't exist in there in a way that it exists in other places, but it exists. It exists, and it's ugly what they're doing in there. So it's not every correctional officer, but, you know, these unions are too strong. They try to get rid of correctional officers. They go to their unions, and now they're talking about walking out on a job. And, you know, this is extortion. And there's a lot of things that have to change, and a lot of attention needs to bring to what's happening in these places so that people can start saying, hey, I work. I pay taxes, man. I don't want this stuff going on. I don't want to, you know, be paying taxes for you to release a guy that's going to kill my daughter because you didn't prepare him or he wasn't prepared. And you know, I'm working on a lot of things with lawyers and a lot of people to bring attention to this, but also to do something about it.
I asked him again to describe the prison experience.
It was adverse. It was bad. I want to put this in a nutshell for every parent, every mother and father, and married couple out there. You know, you enjoy the luxury of coming home to your spouse and, you know, giving them a kiss or having this conversation about life, right? Imagine you having this time interrupted every single day. And any time you see your spouse or your loved one or your child, you're scrutinized. You're burnt to a point of indignation that it just devalues you as a person. And, you know, from my perspective as a man, it devalued me. But, you know, can you imagine your wife and daughter and or your husband having to walk through them gates and submit to, you know, checks by correctional officers, because they have the ultimate discretion to just say, you know what, that chick right there, you know, I'm going to search her. I'm going to have her go in a room and take off her bras, you know, take off her panties. Yeah, we're going to have female correctional officers do it, but it's just to discourage you from visiting your loved one. This is what happens in there. And these are what type of people that we have working in there, and there's no recourse.
I asked about his family and how they supported him during his incarceration.
And it's like I said, she's the, you know, I always tell my wife, she's the best thing and the best decision I made in my life, you know. And that's the truth. And I'm out here now, and every day I think about, you know, how am I going to help my family? And, you know, to this day, there's no job offers or anything, nobody, but I'm doing the work I need to do. And I know everything happens in time. So, you know, soon I'll be doing speaking engagements. Soon I'll be hopefully shopping my book, and I'll be out in the public. And I know that this is what, you know, that I was put in this earth for. You know, I went through this, and it's unfortunate. I'm not happy about it. I don't celebrate it. I don't glamorize it. I can't say nothing good about prison, but that there are men in there that are innocent, and there are men in there that have made mistakes in their lives that have changed. Could I say that about everybody? No. The majority, no. But there's individuals in there that deserve that. You know, whether they're innocent or whether they just made a mistake in their life when they were kids. You know, you got this one guy in there that I'm working on his case. He's been in there since he's 16. He's been in there 40 years. He's 56 now. He has no institutional record, no drug record, no violence, no fighting. But the parole board keeps hitting him and keeping him in prison. And it's so arbitrary, knowing the facts of the scientific evidence that has been proven about a teenager and an adult. And so they're basically still judging him on being a 16-year-old. And this man has done everything possible to, you know, to show them that, you know, he's ashamed. He wished that he was never there, because he was the one that actually committed the crime. And it's so funny that, you know, even the appellate court said the only reason he got sentenced more than the guys that actually did the crime that were older than him is because he went to trial. He went to trial and told the judge the truth as a 16-year-old would perceive things at that point. A 16-year-old is not going to be, well, I knew it was going to happen, I should have stopped it. A 16-year-old is going to think, well, that's not my job to stop these guys from doing that. So he went to trial and said that, like, yeah, I knew they was going to do that, but, you know, he's 40 years old, I'm 16, what do you want me to do? I was scared of the guy. So you understand, and you know, it's unfortunate people lost their lives. And I told them that, do you not realize that people lost their lives, and you could have stopped that by just making a phone call? And he tells me, yeah, I know that now, but what can I do about that now? You know, I wish. It's sad to see, because I believe me, I'm not just going to put my name behind things that are no good. The environment is detestable. The criminals, the murderers, the disgusting people in there, you have them. And correctional officers as well. You know, I learned finally to not be combative in the way that I was for the first 15 years.
I asked him to tell me more about that.
I was very combative the first 15 years. I felt indignant that a man could tell me I can't call my wife. You know, that a man would tell me that I can't talk to my children. That a man would tell me that I can't kiss my children. That a man would tell me that I can't have my daughter on my lap. You know, so, you know, I had a lot of trouble in there, because I felt, you know, I felt like, you're not going to take away my right. I don't even belong here. For the first 15 years, I'm on this book, man. I was waging a battle in there that was psychological. You know, I've been assaulted by officers. I've been assaulted by inmates. And, you know, I've defended myself because, you know, they would like to make me look like the aggressor or the person that was in there. Oh, this guy is just a piece of crap. But, you know, I would want people, because I know if you ask them, they're going to be like, look at what this guy was in here, fights, assaults and all this. And but people wouldn't know that, why that happened. Why did I have to fight a guy trying to come in my cell to steal something that my family sent me? Because he saw a skinny 22-year-old kid that he thought was going to be a punk and let him take his stuff. You understand? Why should I let a correctional officer slap me in the face because he feels that I have no right? And although it's against the law for him to do that, he still did it. You know why? Because he could get away and there's no cameras to show that he slapped me. And that's why I defended myself by turning around, and now they jumped me, and they justified the reason why they jumped me, because I'm nobody. So this is what happens every day in there. So I show two examples, one with inmates and one with police. And they'll tell you, yeah, this guy was a piece of crap in here. Look, he didn't follow orders. But if you look deep enough, because I have plenty of evidence to show how they set me up, because one thing that I got while I was in prison is an education, but it's not because the Department of Corrections gave it to me. It's because I took my time every time I was in that cage to read and educate myself. It was in college. It was in school. It was me. Every time I was in that box locked up for 24 hours a day, eating rations that are given in, like, you know, prison camps in Austria or something. You know, when you eat rations like that in your cell and they're messing with your food, and sometimes you can't eat your food because they've done spit in it, because they tamper your food, then people would could tell me, you know, what they would have done. You know, you boil up in a corner and die, or you stand up. And, you know, I'm thankful I never committed a crime in there that, you know, took somebody's life or hurt somebody. But I've defended myself. I've defended myself, and I've had my fights. And, you know, I like being honest with all that stuff so people could understand. Listen, I don't justify it. I don't say it's okay that I reacted in that way to confrontations. But the truth of the matter is this. I had to do what I felt in my heart at that moment I had to do to protect me, to protect myself, and to make sure that I got home to my family alive. I've been stabbed. I've been cut. I've been assaulted by gangs, and I've been fought every one of them fights like a man.
I told Mr. Rosario that I noticed that he had been through a lot of trauma, and I asked him if he had been given the opportunity to find help for the mental trauma he had experienced.
I need to unwind and talk to somebody eventually about everything. But, you know, it always brings me back to what I went through. And it was very traumatic. Because if you hear it, I'm more than sure your listeners are going to hear it in my voice. I mean, you know what? Being in there and saying, damn, I need to talk to somebody. I need to talk. Maybe I can talk to a mental health provider in there. And maybe, you know, they can help me and give me some relief or something. I don't want medication. I just need somebody to talk to tell them what I'm feeling. And do you know that I was discouraged by watching mental health providers talking to correctional officers after they talked to inmates and telling them he's bullshitting, he's lying, he said his mother died, he said this. You understand? How could I trust them? How could you trust these people? And now this is a big issue I have. I don't trust people. You know, the people who I associate are individuals like yourself that are giving light to something that's important that affected my life. But other than that, I don't socialize. I'm at home all day with my wife and my kids. I write, and I get out at times with friends that come see me, but it's not too many people. I don't associate with people in my past that I grew up with. I just don't have time for none of that. And I'm just looking forward to getting the support from, you know, the public to do what I know that I could do. I just need the public to be behind me, and there's going to be some work, but I'm going to do it.
I asked Richard what advice he might have for someone who was wrongfully convicted.
It's hard for me to narrow it down, but I can boil it up in one nutshell. Never give up, man. Never stop dreaming. Never stop, you know, finding ways to fight, to expose it. Never give up. Never give up, and I guarantee that every year that passes is going to pass quick, and you have it in your mind. And one day, you know, no matter how long it takes, it's like I said, it took 20 years for this one day. And, you know, I live every day like it counts.
I wanted to know what Richard thought the general public should do to help people who find themselves in situations similar to his own.
Well, the first thing, I'm starting a program called Inspire that's going to, you know, really be able to give people a way to help directly with the problem. But the underlying problem that people got to understand is they're public servants. If you're in a county and there's 40 exonerations, that means 40 men were wrongfully convicted. And these 40 men between them have done between a decade and 30 years. There's a problem. There's a problem because these are the ones that they're admitting, right? Or the ones that we have found out about. But now we don't know how many more cases there are. And they have cases, you know, they're presenting cases to district attorneys and they don't want to look at them. They want to defend these convictions to the end. So you can imagine 20 years they defended my convictions. The federal courts, the EPA Act, it has to be abolished. They took the power from the federal courts to grant you habeas relief if your constitutional right was violated. This is what's supposed to protect us, the constitutional rights. So the state courts are the ones responsible, so we have to hold them responsible. We have to hold from our, you know, borough president or county representative all the way up to the Senate, at Congress. We have to start putting people in place and voting people out and telling them what we want. The people must demand what they want. And it has to start at the bottom. So poor people, low-income people, for the most part, do not register as party members.
I asked Richard how people could contact him and if there was anyone in particular he would like to thank.
Well, I got a GoFundMe page, and I want to thank everybody from Jason Flom from Lyle Records, Stephen Hobbs, Heather West. There's so many people that have been there. Kevin Bacon. I mean, these people, and I tell them, I'm not looking for a photo op. I'm looking for your voices to help me get this off, man. I suffer greatly, man, and I want to make sure that my life and my legacy is not one of a victim. It's one of a victor, you understand? So that's my whole motto going forward. And all the people that donated to my GoFundMe, you know, the $8,000, which helped me help my wife and my kids, you know, and buy clothes that, you know, people could see me in NBC's Conviction, my friend Dan Slepin, the producer, you know, people could just go to my GoFundMe, and if they feel in their heart to give something, to make a comment on my Facebook, my Twitter, Richard Rosario, the journey continues, and I'm doing it. I'm out here, and I'm happy, and I talk passionately about this because it affected me, but I don't think about it every single moment. I enjoy being with my wife, with my dogs, with my daughter, my beautiful son, and I enjoy those moments in life as opposed to letting what I went through affect me. But don't get it wrong. I do suffer from PTSD, but unlike a lot of people, I was more prepared because I immersed myself in a world of books and reading and law, and you know, it's constantly driving me somewhere, and I just let it drive me. And you know, when my wife tells me I have to slow down, sit down, and she puts me in check, I have to listen, and I do. But you know, I'm loving the experience.
I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening. The Actual Innocence Podcast website is www.actualinpod.com. That's actualinpod.com. Share your feedback and questions by emailing actualinnocencepod@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @actualinpod. Please show your support by rating us and giving us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, or by becoming one of our Patreon sponsors by clicking the support link on our website. Remember, sharing this podcast and the stories of those who have been exonerated help to fix our criminal justice system. I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening.